Hi, and welcome to the Data Engineering Podcast, hosted by Cynthia. I'm Jason Gould. I'll be looking after the discussion every week. We'll cover a host of topics like DevOps and tooling, programming languages, strategies, and all that kind of stuff. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy it. Hopefully, we'll catch you next time. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Data Platform Podcast, Episode 2. My name's Jason, work for a company called Cynthia, and with me today I have Tomo, Eva, and Philip. If you guys want to introduce yourselves.
Yeah, sure. My name is Tomo, I'm a Chief Data Architect in Cynthia.
Hi, I'm Eva, and I'm a Senior Data Engineer in Cynthia.
Hello, I'm Philip, and I'm just a measly Data Engineer.
Cool, welcome guys. Today's episode, we're going to talk about programming languages, specifically programming languages that we use in data engineering. We're not going to say for data engineering, because that implies there's an against data engineering, yeah. As Tomo mentioned to me the other day. Yeah. So, Tomo, what do you want to say?
Well, actually, Philip and Eva are the stars here, because I just draw things.
Just draw boxes.
Yeah, I just draw things. And then I, from time to time, I take a look at the code. No, I'm interesting. I mean, in the career that I went through in the last 20 years, there were a lot of discussions about, you know, functional programming versus object-oriented programming, and new languages appeared in the meantime. Some old ones gained popularity. But right now, I see that in data engineering, at least in what we deliver as a company, we mostly use Python and Java and Go. So I don't know, I would like to hear what guys think. What do you think, Eva? What do you like the most and why?
What I like the most? Well, obviously Java, because that's the language I'm most familiar with. I developed quite a few applications in it, and yeah, I can say that I know it well. Well, I would also like to mention one additional language that you haven't mentioned.
Scala.
SQL.
SQL, yeah.
Because you cannot go without SQL in
yes.
data engineering.
Actually, that's also a language. I forget that from time to time. Yeah. And that's
there's a clue in the name.
Yeah, and
that's a query language.
Yes, and that's a pure functional programming language, so yeah. Cool. And what do you think, I mean, okay, now you said what you mean about Java and all other languages, but what do you find lacking in Java when creating? Because at least what I think is that we deliver, our deliveries are in these three programming languages, and Fortran, if we took SQL also in. But I would say that mostly we use Python. I think that most of our code is in Python, and on internal products is in Go.
Well, yeah, what I find lacking in Java, I don't really find any lacks in Java. I just think it is a bit verbose for most of our tasks.
Yeah.
So I see why most people have turned to Python, especially when we think about data science as a whole. Python is kind of the top language there. But if we want to do something that is more computational heavy and such, I would look for other languages such as Java or Go, and some languages that can support multi-threading and yeah, process things faster than Python.
Mm-hmm.
Python is easy as a language. It is not as heavy as Java, and I can see why most people coming new. Learning languages tend to go for Python. My experiences with Python are okay, but coming from object-oriented language such as Java, I find Python to be lacking in some areas. But then again, that's just my personal preference.
Okay, thanks, Philip.
Well,
the same,
yeah,
several questions for you.
Well, she can keep Java. I'll take the rest of them.
Okay.
So, I mean, I like Python. I mean, obviously, most of my university days were spent in Python, but mostly just building dumbass neural networks, but still.
Data science.
Yeah.
but But still, I think it's very fast to write in, mm-hmm. above all. And I think, first and foremost, if we're going to talk about languages and data engineering, we're really sort of dependent on the tools in data engineering when we talk about languages.
Exactly, and for, the APIs.
Yeah, exactly. So you can love programming in R, you know, if you're a psychopath, but if someone tells you to write a data flow job, you're out of luck because you have to be able to write in Apache Beam. So, you know, as much as I can like Python and Go, there's going to be inevitably times when I turn to something else. But I do feel like Go is a versatile enough language to cover most of our use cases so far, with some exceptions. For example, on Azure, you're going to have a hard time writing serverless stuff since they don't really have the workers for it. But Go and Python are the ones I've had the most experience with, and those are generally the ones I would stick with so far.
I mean, our internal choice in Syntio when we create our own products is Go. And I think mostly because we want to focus on the functionality of the app and not learning the frameworks, which in Java can be quite extensive learning curve. And I'm not going to go into size of executable created in Go and compare it to something created in Java. But yeah, so it's, yeah, but I mean, of course, if you are coding something that needs to work in Beam, you will use Java or any other.
Well, you can use Java, Python, or Go, to be honest.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really depends, as Philip said, on the tools that you're going to use and which languages are supported by it.
Do we see a difference in languages in terms of ones that are obviously compiled and then interpreted? In terms of performance of product,
of course, Python is slow. Obviously, I mean, unless you're using libraries that are actually secretly C libraries, but it again depends on the size of your application too. Sometimes it's not going to matter if you just need to take a request and then pass it on somewhere else. Python will do fine too. But generally, you know, it shouldn't be the first choice if we're talking performance.
Do we actually see then that same performance issue with Java, which effectively is a semi-interpreted language?
I wouldn't know for Java.
Compared to
Go, for example.
Oh, I'm not sure, but I can say that Java is faster than Python. The thing with Java is that it needs Java Virtual Environment to actually run in. So that is the main issue here. With Go, you can actually run it without a separate virtual environment, basically. So it really comes down to how different processors can actually run the executable of Go.
And obviously then with Java, you get that extreme portability. Is that a problem with Go then, that you have to compile it for the platform that you're going to run it on?
Not particularly. I mean, it again depends on, I mean, most of the time you're going to be running it in a Linux container.
Yes, exactly. I think that the container solved a lot of issues with runtimes.
Yeah. And when it comes to Go, I feel like it's probably on the faster side overall because it's a C family language, so you have a lot more control over memory and things like that. But again, I haven't myself ever sat down and compared it with, you know, other languages. But I feel like it's one of its main draws is its speed.
Okay, so seeing as Go's the new kid on the block, it's a relatively new language compared to the others we've mentioned. I mean, I'm fairly old and I remember coding in Python a lot of years ago.
Yeah.
And obviously coding in Java a lot of years ago when I was still coding. So Go's relatively new. One of the beauties of Java is that it's used so extensively that we know what every problem with it is and what the workaround is, what to avoid, and all that kind of stuff. Are we still in the position with Go where we're learning about those things we shouldn't do?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, up until a year ago, I could barely even read Go, so it's definitely still a learning experience. One of the things we mostly struggled with was coming in from more object-oriented languages to show up with Go, and it's like, oh, there's no inheritance. Oh, there's no overriding functions. Oh, there's no abstractions at all. I just get interfaces? Well,
Well, thank designers of Go for that.
Yeah,
it's
interesting because they say that like Go supports object-oriented paradigms, but what they actually mean is they support messaging in the sense that you can put the level of abstraction on top of it, but if you want something more like Java, wherein you have inheritance, well, you're going to have some problems just like we did, where we had to basically use workarounds like embedded structs and stuff like that, which also led to some questionable design decisions at times where we just sort of had to think, okay, well, I can't think of like normal inheritance, so I gotta have this struct, which isn't this struct, so it can access this struct.
Of course.
Still learning.
Yeah.
You cannot really progress if you don't make mistakes along the way.
Sure.
So if we notice that something does not really fit, then of course we will change it, and we are changing it.
And how boring would your life be if you didn't learn anything new?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole objective, isn't it? Is to continually learn and enjoy.
Yeah, especially in IT, and especially in data engineering. New tools coming out every week, I would say.
Yeah.
And yeah, you need to keep up.
Twice a week.
And do you think that's a problem, the keeping up part?
I think you need to focus your energy on certain areas. You cannot tackle all of them, especially not at once.
Mm.
Because jumping between your daily tasks and your personal life and everything, it can be really draining to keep up with everything.
What exactly personal life? Is that something that you're going to ask?
Not familiar with that
concept. Okay, yeah, sure.
So what mental steps do you go through when you decide what to focus on then? Or is it really around your task at hand that you go, I need to learn this for this particular job? Or do you look at the technologies that are coming out and going, actually, that one looks super interesting and I could see how it would fit in many use cases? Or what's the process you go through?
Yeah, I try to assess what I'm using now and which of the tools can help me now. And also I try to look a bit ahead, like what are my goals or career goals, and to see which of the new technologies can actually benefit me in the long run. So it comes down to both.
So no crystal ball, though, that says this technology is going to be...
No crystal ball. I mean, sometimes the marketing can be really good for some new technologies and tools. So, it usually takes around a few days playing with something to realize if this is something that it's going to help me in the future or not. And yeah.
And then throw it away if it's no use.
Yeah.
And is that the same process for you?
For me, I just take it on sort of a task-to-task basis, because the thing is, when you sort of look at all the cloud platforms and all the technologies, it gets overwhelming. So if you just focus on a task and then try to find technologies relevant to the problem at hand, it's much easier to go through and parse through, and you're much more likely to learn it. Now, when I'm not the type of person that's going to be home on a Saturday evening and then, you know, be like, let me Google some new technologies.
Really?
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 It isn't. I just watch YouTube videos like a sad and lonely person.
But Saturday morning?
No, I mean, on Saturday mornings, I don't even wake up. On Friday, I picked up a book on Rust.
Yes, yes.
And I went through the first 70 pages, very, very optimistic. I've seen this before. I mean, come on, it's simple. And then I got to chapter 4, which is on borrowing, a term that I was like, okay, well, I mean, I never heard of this term, but come on, how hard could it be? 10 pages later, I wanted to basically explode because it was ridiculous. I'd never seen anything like it in a programming language.
Yeah.
But Rust is actually interesting, also an interesting subject. It's right up there in terms of like emergent popularity with Go, but it's definitely a very different approach than Go. The most important difference being that Go has a garbage collector and Rust does not. But data engineering wise, there's also the main difference of Go has a lot more support with individual cloud platforms than Rust.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Rust is interesting. Data ownership and data borrowing is super interesting concepts. He doesn't have a garbage collector because he doesn't need one, which is great. No garbage, nothing to collect and release.
I would argue that maybe half the stuff going in is garbage.
Yeah. But overall, yeah, I think you're right. We have to keep an eye on everything that is enabling us when we are talking about data engineering. I think it can be divided into pure backend programming, where we try to interface our data processing with the available tools and processing and computational engines, and the part where we actually have to structure the data, clean the data and everything else that I always forget, which is why we need to mention SQL from time to time and frameworks like data frames for Python and Scala and all this nice Spark stuff that is available also for in-memory processing. So yeah, I think that all the languages that are now mentioned, I feel that it's good to know all of them. I mean, we also have to think when we are delivering something to the client that we can't use technologies that client can't find anyone to take over. The ownership of the code that we create and deliver, that's also
Is this a problem that we have here in Cynthia quite a lot, actually, is the... I mean, bearing in mind, you know, data engineering is a relatively new field. Yeah. There aren't that many people around doing data engineering specifically. Yes. Is this then give us a problem when we go to hand over to our clients?
Could be, but we learned that it could be a problem. So then we try to agree in the beginning.
Mitigate against it.
Exactly. What are we going to use? I mean, and I can tell you 85% of clients say use Python. This is something that we can find talent on the market. The rest 15 don't ask a thing. They say, well, we don't care if it works.
Yeah.
So
not much Java then for you either.
No.
Python out and go in.
Yeah. There was Scala also at some point, but yeah.
But the thing about Scala is that, like, you're not going to use it anywhere that isn't Spark, really.
Yeah, and it's pure functional programming language.
It's not. I mean, I wouldn't call it a pure functional. Like, the whole thing with Scala is that it's somewhere in the middle, right?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's how they represent it to you. It's like somewhere in between object-oriented and functional programming.
But it doesn't keep data and objects.
I mean, you have classes.
Yeah, you can have classes, but they're not meant to be used, I think. You think that you should use classes in Scala?
Now that you're looking at yeah. me like that and sort of like...
No, I mean, if you would use Scala framework as... You're right, actually. If you would use a Scala framework outside of the Spark, then yes, you would use objects to store data in Spark.
Yeah, but my point was, data engineering-wise, there isn't much use for Scala that isn't... Spark, unless you really, really prefer Scala.
Exactly. I would also agree on that. I think that Scala is also used, some of the companies that are creating Java backend for the last couple of years, they also switched to Scala for some of the mobile apps backend or something like that.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm not saying Scala is bad or necessarily a worse option. It's just that from my experience so far, there wasn't any... clear field where I was just like, oh, I like Scala, I'm going to use Scala. But since you mentioned functional programming, it has sort of seen an emergence in general when it comes to, like, a lot more people are getting more hyped up about functional programming. But my question is more, so in discussions with functional programming, you know, when they give their little talks and stuff, the main argument against object-oriented is they use the term spaghetti code.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my question would sort of be, you know, how you would define spaghetti code. Because for me, when I was in university, what they did was, on my first year, they showed me a go-to statement in C, and I was like, that's spaghetti code. Yeah. And I was just like, okay, I'm not going to use go-to, my code's going to be perfect. But
they tell you it exists, but do not use it.
Yeah. You will fail the exam if we see go-to.
It.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. I can tell you what was the spaghetti code meaning when I started working. That was 20 years ago.
14 years ago, don't listen to him.
Whenever you had a lot of logic written down in a single piece of executable code, which couldn't be reused in any way, and that same logic could be used for someone else, for some other purpose, that was called spaghetti code. So you usually, what spaghetti, I mean, premature optimization as a way of thinking always leads to spaghetti code, because nothing can work better than something that you put, you know, from beginning to the end just for that purpose, super optimized, you know, and that can turn out to be spaghetti, because tomorrow Eva will come and say, have you solved the issue with, I don't know, some casting some types from this to that, and I would say, yeah, it's in my code, copy paste it in your code. So what did we do there? So the two of us know how that works. We both have it in our... So that's what we used to call spaghetti code.
I wouldn't necessarily call that spaghetti code. I think that's just non-modular code. Or non... I mean, spaghetti code is badly designed code.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't necessarily call it that spaghetti code. I feel like what most people, when they criticize object-oriented programming, spaghetti code mean is that, like, you start with a design, you have your old... inheritance stuff, class goes into class, and then as you're building the building system, at some point you realize, oh, now I've got this whole architecture, but I got this one component that I can't, if I put it in this class, then this class can get into it, and then if I put it here, then that class, so you build these connections in your finely created tree, and it's like,
oh, okay,
yeah,
I call that crap. Not spaghetti, but crap. Yeah. Yeah, that's bad design.
Yeah, I mean, all again, spaghetti code is bad code no matter how you look at it. But
is this then the argument? I mean, we spoke about this a little bit last week about loosely coupling stuff and all that kind of thing. And for me, a big part of this is that we as humans like to keep hold of the things we've made because they have a perceived value. Whereas I found in my career, actually, the best way to do something is not to continually maintain something, but to actually make it small enough architecturally that I can just throw it away and replace it. Mm-hmm. And that way we can avoid some of that sort of spaghettifying everything and everything being reliant on everything else.
Although, what also have to be said, I think that in my view of spaghetti code, which is different from Philip's, spaghetti code is usually super optimized. It is optimized, it is quick, it is fast, and it works well.
It solves one problem.
It solves one problem in one specific way, and nobody else can use any of it or know how to fix it once it stops working.
So it's obviously...
For embedded systems that you are not going to change ever, maybe it's not... Yeah, it's great.
So... I had one on programming languages specifically because, you know, effectively, as we discussed last time, you know, data engineering is a subset of software engineering. Mm. And it's a small but growing community of people that do data engineering. Where is the space, as you guys are all coders, where is the space for the point and click stuff?
Oh.
We don't like to talk about that.
but surely if we're in a situation where there are not that many data engineers and I can give a software engineer that doesn't know data maybe just the ability to drag and drop connections and point and click stuff, does that actually solve any problems or are we just building future problems today?
I mean, are you asking of like from existing tool sets how important... How prevalent or how effective such solutions are, or are you asking us, should we build stuff like that?
I think both, actually, because for me, obviously, you know, it makes it easier for somebody who's maybe not a data engineer native to be able to get to a solution, especially if you're having problem actually hiring data engineering resources. Yeah. But then my concern is that, you know, I now have my organization relying on unoptimized ways of doing stuff that nobody actually understands necessarily what's going on underneath the bonnet.
I'll go last.
I mean, I haven't used a whole lot of pointing and clicking tools from the existing tool set. The only one that comes to mind is like Azure Data Factory, which was a fine enough experience, I guess. But generally, and this is my personal preference, I would just sit down and code it. Because first off, if we build certain tool sets to enable future data engineers, the thing is that there's a risk of them becoming reliant on it. And then for either previously made systems or systems that can't be solved through pointing and clicking, they're just not going to be as effective in it as if they just opened up an IDE and programming themselves. There's also the fact that like we will need to divert resources to build those tools and maintain those pointing and clicking tools, which again requires not only knowing data engineering but how to build.
But I mean, there are a lot of, I say a lot, there are a number of companies offering these as a solution out the box, aren't they, as an off-the-shelf product.
Yeah, I mean more like from our point of view, as like
for our own products,
for our purposes and as an internal product, let's say. So that's my view. I wouldn't necessarily put too much stock on it. It is useful to have, but I wouldn't necessarily call it
the product. Solves a problem for today, but could create one for tomorrow.
Sure. Yeah, that's one way to put it.
Eva?
Oh, it's my turn.
Yeah.
I can see some pro sides for the pointy and clicky tools, especially as you said, the people that are not really into the data engineering as such, or people that come from classic data warehousing or relational databases where they extensively use SQLs and procedures. There are tools out there that can actually give you both. So you can create your pipelines with drag and drop boxes and connect them with lines and similar, but you can also do custom transformations and similar by inputting your SQL query. So you can combine both of it. My main concern with this is that we are not really aware of how those pipelines are executed, how well are they executed, and usually they cover a lot of, especially integration ones, they cover a lot of different connectors, but you know, we cannot really have everything working well in one tool. So I'm really, it comes down to testing it out, trying it out on a simple use case that you have to see how well does it perform. I mean, we also need to take in account that pipelines, especially in a big data world, need to cover a different amount of data. It can be really high in frequency and in volume, and at sometimes it is not. There aren't any messages arriving or similar. So those tools also need to be really scalable, and I still need to find a tool that can cover.
So from a short-term get you out of trouble use case, then you'd say, if that's your only option, then fine.
Yeah.
I mean, my concern with all of these things, and I have this with a lot of stuff, is that today's solution is tomorrow's problem. And I find that when we bring in these things, we say, we're going to do everything in this. Okay, well now what we've just done is made that thing a dependency for everything.
Yeah, you've blocked yourself.
Yeah, and then you tightly coupled your entire architecture, and if you want to change it, well, sorry, now we have to change everything.
Yeah.
And those are my concerns with those kind of things. Tomo, you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why those tools, point-and-click tools like Informatica or Oracle Warehouse Builder or such things were popular. When you had databases or files as your main, I would say, ingestion data points. But right now, you know, it's APIs, it's message brokers, it's message queues, all kinds of data flowing in. Still, you have databases and files, but the systems, source systems, have grown in all directions. And you don't have one or two environments that you have to connect to. You can have them in smaller organizations, but usually they have a lot of things scattered around. Creating integration plans, integration procedures in a tool I think is a highly dangerous thing, because then you are, as you already mentioned, both of you, all three of you, you are solving today's problem, but you're tying yourself to another platform which you have to learn. Learning those tools, learning that new platform, learning all the properties, features, all the things, depending on vendor, I don't think that's easier than just learning Python. I think that, you know, it's a misconception, a huge misconception. I have worked with Informatica. It's not easy to use it. It's not easy to debug it when it doesn't work as you wish. It's super hard because it's a black box. You are more or less, your hands are tied. You can just look at it and, you know, restart the server or whatever happens. And you need people who, I mean, the people who usually are like Jedis of that world of point and click tools, they all have like 20 years of experience looking at those tools, working with those tools, helping other work with those tools. Mm. So more or less, you know, you are like in 20 years of coding Python, you will also know something and you will be able to help people. I'm not saying that those tools don't have their place, as Eva mentioned, but I think I would avoid them, if possible, in ingestion phase. Once you get the data ingested in your data warehouse, then, you know, go wild with it. Use whatever you want. But for integrations and for the whole, like the whole environment surrounding your data platform, I don't think that you can use point and click tools. I mean, let's just make clear that data warehouse is just one product on your data platform. Mm-hmm. If you're building data warehouse in cloud, well, okay. But it's usually not the only one. I mean, times are changing. You don't have dashboards and reports as your main consumer anymore.
No. So we go back to the point of today's talk then, which was programming languages, and we say that program languages gets a big thumbs up, and pointy and clicky stuff, as Eva said, gets a, yeah, use it today, but think about tomorrow.
Exactly, yeah.
Cool.
I think that's a good conclusion for today.
Cool. Right, guys, as Tomo just said, that's all from us today. We will see you on the next episode, which we can't tell you what it's going to be about, but I'm sure it will be super exciting.
Yeah, we'll think of something.
Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.